Yesterday was the Celtic holiday of Lugnasa. It actually began on Saturday night. The Celtic days, like the Jewish days, begin sundown the night before. So Lugnasa was Saturday night through Sunday daytime. And what is Lugnasa, you might wonder? If you think of the year as a great circle, and imagine that it has a light half, or kind of a yang half, and then a lower half, or a yin half. And there are important days at the top, the bottom, and then at the crossing from light to dark on each side. Those are the four quarter days in the Irish calendar. Lugnasa is the peak of the light time of the year. It's the midsummer festival in the Celtic world. And it's seen in many ways as, you might say, a masculine pole of the year, a kind of yang pole of the year. The yin pole is in February. Lugnasa, the name comes from the god Lug, who was the god, multi-talented god who could do everything. And many of the Lug legends got taken over by St. Patrick. They were ascribed to St. Patrick, who later became the spiritual father of Ireland once Christianity arrived. And so I wanted to talk this evening about masculinity, about archetypal masculinity. And I guess the very first thing I want to say is I'll be talking about the masculine and the feminine, and I want to make very clear, I'm talking about this archetypal level. I would say that the archetypal masculine and archetypal feminine are in all of us, you know, and they're as it were wells of wisdom within all of us. And we can choose to draw on them in various ways. I'll just share in my life that part of my journey, I find that as I step more into the archetypal masculine, I step more into my own authentic power. And it's precisely by opening to the archetypal feminine that allows me to go deeper into my archetypal masculine. I'll say that I've had that, you know, I've talked with other straight men and they've had similar experiences. I've also talked to some straight women who have talked about a kind of complementary experience that they step more into their power as they cultivate the deep archetypal feminine within them, and the masculine helps them go deeper into their feminine. I would call this at best anecdotal data. You know, it's not for me to say certainly what is true even for all straight people, let alone for, you know, what might be true for people on the LGBTQ spectrum. You know, how people identify, how people, you know, all of that. All I can say is I do believe that these two wells of wisdom are within all of us, and all of us have some, you know, some possibility of developing a relationship with this wisdom. So the masculine, I think one way to talk about it is in terms of our perception of the world and the way we process information, the masculine is more on the side of what I would call discrimination or differentiation, ability to tell the difference between closely related things. And it'd be more of a quality of the feminine to see the interconnection, to bring disparate things together. To some extent, these are simply the hemispheric differences that I'm talking about, left brain versus right brain. The left brain is the brain of differentiation. It allows us to tell the difference between similar things. The right brain is the great pattern matching system that allows us to put separate things into an overarching pattern. And of course, when I'm talking about it simply this way, it sounds more like a head thing, and I don't think masculinity is really a head thing. But I would say that when discrimination is put into action, that is decisiveness, and that is a powerful quality of the archetypal masculine, decisiveness. Um, with all of these qualities of the archetypal masculine, I would say, you know, there's a healthy side and there's also a dark side. The dark side of the decisiveness might be, you know, as it gets, as it gets wrapped up with control issues and a person is saying, well, I'm going to make all the decisions. I don't want input from anyone, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that might be a good place to pause the litany of the masculine for a second and just to acknowledge the quality of vulnerability. Vulnerability is associated very much with the archetypal feminine, but I think it's important to presence because, first of all toxic masculinity is completely devoid of vulnerability. And a lot of the dysfunctional masculinity we see in the world, I would say, is in one way or another a failure to occupy vulnerability fully. And so vulnerability is a powerful example of how the archetypal feminine allows any man to go deeper into masculinity. Vulnerability, I'd say, really has to underlie all these masculine qualities in order for them to be healthy. What was I going to say next? Related to decisiveness, this has to do more with the area of personal growth. The archetypal masculine mode of personal growth is about pushing through boundaries, about breakthroughs. If you think about inner breakthroughs, for example. And really, it can also show up in the world in crossing into the unknown, the kind of exploratory aspect of engaging in the world. Again, the archetypal feminine mode of especially concerning inner growth, would be more holding something and allowing it to transform before allowing it to open up. And I'd really say, ultimately, we need both in our spiritual growth. There are times that all I can do is hold the process in me and just let it sit, let it do its thing. And there's also times when I've been sitting too long and I need to push through to the next level, you know, and we need both of those. Related to that, I'd say, a lot of the ways that pushing through and transgressing shows up in external life is not very good, you know, crossing other people's boundaries and, stepping on their toes, that sort of thing. Although I will point out what I might call socially positive transgressions. And what I mean by that is, you know, for example, I hike often in Redwood Regional. And I know the park inside out. I have kind of a geometer's mind, so the whole map of the place is in my head. And it's not unusual for me to be hiking along and to find people standing under the redwood, puzzling over a map or staring into their phone, you know, having a conversation about what trail to take. And I often go up to them and just say, do you know where you're going? Or, you know, do you need any help or something like that? You know, and I'm transgressing, I'm interrupting their conversation, I'm interrupting their train of thought. But often those people are appreciative of the help that I give, you know? And so I think there certainly are ways to insert yourself slightly, you know, with a joke, with a smile, with a compliment that actually is socially positive. And of course that requires, you know, a great deal of emotional intelligence to do that. Another aspect of the masculine, for this, I want to talk about the marriage vows, the very traditional marriage vows. Say 100 years ago, when everyone was taking these vows, men would promise to love, honor, and serve. Women would promise to love, honor, and obey. I remember having had an older professor in graduate school, and he had been married for like 40 years, and he said that he and his wife had this long-standing kind of you know, friendly disagreement and this friendly bantering they did about, you know, one of them swore to serve, the other one swore to obey. Which one really got the better deal of it? You know, that kind of thing. I don't want to say too much about the obey. The obey, I think there are ways that, especially in other times and other places, that there is a kind of wisdom of obedience. I think that's something that is distant from our worldview in America. And in particular, you know, I think saying, you know, trying to link women with obey in 2021, that's not something that's going to be very positive. But I would say that serving, I think actually does speak to something deep about the masculine, to serve, to give support. And the masculine nature of serving and giving support, it often has the quality of seeing, the kind of far-seeing, you know, for example, mirroring somebody, I see this gift in you, that kind of thing. Or creating the conditions, simply creating the conditions where people are able to step into their wholeness, step into their greater selves, you know, to, as it were, to extend the invitation that allows people to step forth into their greater selves. I would call those along the lines of the masculine. And again, I would say a dark side would be more like a patronizing or an infantilizing, you know, let me take care of you because you can't take care of yourself, that kind of thing. I'll say the feminine has many different faces. The feminine support, I think, is everything from, you know, the nurturing mother, you know, with all the care and love possible, to the fierceness of Kali eating our intestines to relieve us of our, you know, our inauthenticity, you know. Another aspect of the masculine, I would say, has to do with solidity and grounding. And this is related to ideas of being reliable, being trustworthy. And part of that is in the solidity is the ability to hold a container. To hold a container for the fluidity of the feminine. And I think in other times, the masculine has gotten, you know, that this has been distorted into, as it were, containing or confining the feminine. But I think it is a powerful form of service, you know, and this can be, you know, a service of a man to a woman, or it can be within any of us, the way that our own archetypal masculine is serving our archetypal feminine. The feminine is about flow. And it's the nature of flow that if it's not directed, it's kind of a trickle in every direction. But when flow is focused, when the masculine can contain the flow in such a way as to focus it, then it's more like a fire hose, you know? And so what are the ways that the masculine can shape the flow of the feminine so that that's more powerful? There's so many images I want to talk about here. First of all, from the Bible, you know, all the images of the men who have some relationship to flow, you know, Jesus walking on the waters, Moses parting the waters. Ultimately, at the creation, Yahweh is hovering over the face of the waters. And even Noah, I would say, you know, Jung had a comment in his alchemical writings, you know, the traditional story we get about Noah is that, you know, he's this obedient little guy and he makes the boat and does what God tells him. In a more alchemical reading of that myth, Noah is kind of a master alchemist who's washing the earth clean, you know. And what is that role within us? So at this point, I'm going to share the quote sheet. So the people in the Zoomies got the quote sheet as a link, and the Roomies will get it as a handout. And the first quote is from the I Ching. The I Ching is the oldest book to talk about yin and yang, and yin and yang is really, in one way, is one of the oldest systems of the archetypal masculine and feminine. This is from one of Confucius's commentaries on hexagram number one. Hexagram number one is six yang lines. It's pure yang, pure masculinity. And sometimes it's called heaven, sometimes it's called the initiating. So in this translation, the way of the initiating is change and transformation, so that each being obtains its true nature and destiny, and the union of the great harmony is preserved. And I really love this image of the support of the masculine creating this space where each being can step into their own nature, you know. From the philosopher Seneca, no man is unhappier than he who never faces adversity, for he is not permitted to prove himself. And there's something about the facing of adversity. I mean, there's something I think that's very human about the facing of adversity, but there's also something in particular about the nature of the courage that it calls forth from a man. You know, it occurs to me, I'm going to pause the quote for a minute and talk about one other quality that I didn't talk about in the talk, and that is confidence. Confidence is very much a quality of the archetypal masculine. And it's a funny thing. Testosterone is confidence juice. As some of you know, I'm a high school teacher. I spend a lot of time with teenagers who are bursting with emotions, and teenage males, they think they're the greatest thing on earth, you know, because their bodies are just charged up with confidence juice, you know. And confidence is often something that women have to, you know, can and have to learn, but it almost is something more natural, especially for testosterone-filled men. And I'd say related to confidence, a few things I'll say about confidence. First of all, confidence, you know, a shallow form of confidence, you know, when I want to present the facade of confidence that I'm really not feeling confident, that comes out of bravado, bragging, you know, let me prove myself, etc. True confidence is actually very quiet. True confidence, I don't need to advertise it at all. I don't need to prove myself to anyone. And true confidence has a powerful relationship with humility. Now, humility is interesting. I wouldn't actually say that humility is archetypally masculine or feminine. I think there's just something so profoundly human about humility. And humility is something that all of us can learn from. But there's also a curious asymmetry with humility that interests me. And here's how I'll frame it. Imagine if I, as a white man, were to say, women, you need to be humble. Or if I were to say, people of color, you need to be humble. Like, that would be awful, you know? Something would be off about that. I think the way I would say it is that for any group that's historically been oppressed, for any group where people are struggling to find their voice, step into their power, I don't know that I'd say humility is the number one virtue that should be cultivated. Seems to me that it might be more something like stepping into your power first and then learning how to use humility to moderate that or something like that. But I think humility, at this particular historical moment, there's a richness for men, especially for white men, to explore the depths of humility. And I'll say also, ostensibly, humility is an opposite of confidence, but there's actually a powerful synergy between them. And I'd say if you find a person who is authentically confident and also authentically humble, You know, that's a good person, you know. I think of Abe Lincoln as someone who really held that balance beautifully, you know, authentically confident, authentically humble. I think of Barack Obama as another man who really embodies it well. Okay, back to the quotes. Marcus Aurelius, waste no more time arguing what a good man should be one. There's a lovely Zen to that. From Frederick Douglass, who was an extraordinary man, the lesson taught by human experience is simply this, is that the man who will get up will be helped up, and the man who will not get up will be allowed to stay down. Personal independence is a virtue, and it is the soul out of which comes the sturdiest manhood. From Walt Whitman, this is from I Sing the Body Electric. The man is not less the soul nor more. He too is in his place. He too is all qualities. He is action and power. The flush of the known universe is in him, especially in teenagers, let me tell you. Scorn becomes him well. Appetite and defiance become him well. The wildest, largest appetites, bliss that is the utmost, sorrow that is the utmost, becomes him well. Pride becomes him. The full-spread pride of man is calming and excellence to the soul. And again, this idea of a very quiet, deep confidence. Knowledge becomes him. He likes it. He always brings everything to the test of himself. Whatever the survey, whatever the sea and the sail, he strikes sounding at last only here. Where else does he strike soundings except here? And that whole idea of bringing everything to the test of himself, I think there's something very powerful there. From Teddy Roosevelt, who I think arguably was our most intellectual president, and also I think in many ways many might have been our most masculine president. He said, "We do not admire the man of timid peace. We admire the man who embodies victorious effort, the man who never wrongs his neighbor, who is prompted to help a friend, but who has the virile qualities necessary to win in the stern strife of actual life." Carl Jung talking about the relation of masculine and feminine. "I've noticed that people usually have not much difficulty in picturing to themselves what is meant by the shadow, even if they would have preferred instead a bit of Latin or Greek jargon that sounds more scientific. But it costs them enormous difficulty to understand what the anima is." Here he's talking obviously about men trying to understand the anima. "They accept her easily enough when she appears in novels or as a film star because she's not... But she is not understood at all when it comes to seeing the role she plays in their own lives, because she sums up everything that a man can never get the better of and never finishes coping with." And that is an excellent description of the relation of man to the archetypal feminine. "Therefore, it remains in a perpetual state of emotionality which must not be touched. The degree of unconsciousness with one meets in this connection is, to put it mildly, astounding. Hence, it is practically impossible to get a man who is afraid of his own femininity to understand what is meant by the anima." And of course, Jung was writing in a different world. I think men now have a different relationship to the femininity than the men he was meeting in his life. But the point is well taken. Albert Einstein said, Try not to become a man of success, but rather a man of value." Success being something very outward and outwardly measured. Gandhi said, "Manliness consists not in bluff, bravado, or loneliness. It consists in daring to do the right thing and facing the consequences, whether it is in matters social, political, or other. It consists in deeds and not words." And of course, we think of Gandhi, who throughout his life, both in first in South Africa and then in India, was taking the stand against immoral laws and willing to take the consequence of going to jail over and over again. Herb Goldberg says, "The male has paid a heavy price for his masculine privilege and power. He is out of touch with his emotions and his body. He's playing the rules of the male game plan with a lemming-like purpose. He is destroying himself emotionally, psychologically, and physically." Again, talking about men who do not cultivate a relationship to their vulnerability, who do not cultivate a relationship to the archetypal masculine, archetypal feminine. Matthew Fox says, When the sacred masculine is combined with the sacred feminine inside each of us, we create the sacred marriage of compassion and passion in ourselves. And I'll say also, Tibetan Buddhism also holds this balance. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's envisioned by the bodhisattvas Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, who has the flaming sword of discrimination. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion. We actually have images of these in this room above the altar. Roger Moore says, submission to the power of the mature masculine energies always brings forth a new masculine personality that is marked by calm, compassion, clarity of vision, and generativity. Waller Newell says, we don't need to reinvent manliness. We only need to will ourselves to wake up from the bad dream of the last few generations and reclaim it in order to extend and enrich the traditions that the formidable under the formidable demands of the present. Maladoma Somme says, the truth is our disconnection with the earth and translates into a kind of disrespect of the feminine. How far can you go in violating the mother that gave you life? As long as the feminine is diminished, the connection between us and the earth will always be underscored by a big question mark. We have abused the earth so much that we don't know what to go in. We must wonder about this increasing masculinity that is translated in terms of repeated violence or love of it. And I'd say the increasing masculinity he's talking about is very much the toxic masculinity, not healthy masculinity. Antonella Gembo Burke says, our culture now is one of masculine triumphalism, in which trans-historically feminine expressions, empathy, sweetness, volubility, warmth, are seen as impediments to a woman's professional trajectory in many sectors. Liba Grand simply says, I believe that a woman's sensuality makes the best of a man. And there is, I think, a way when, at least in a heterosexual relationship, and it may be also in some gay relationships, that when one partner is holding the masculine powerfully and another is holding the feminine powerfully, that polarity creates a tremendous energy that really brings out the best in both. Finally, Dr. Denise Ray says, the redefining of the sacred male principle is the dawn of a new vibrant light. A mature masculinity that is not abusive, domineering, or grandiose, but generative, creative, and empowering. He is vulnerable without shame, revealing that his now discarded armor of invulnerability was nothing more than an illusion that hid his true power. He is now free and open to rediscover and reconnect with the power of nature and the cosmos. He is ready to establish true relationships with authenticity and integrity. The great mystery moves through him, reminding him constantly that he is it and it is him. He is a force of nature first, a man second, a spear of Gaia herself, and no amount of perceived invulnerability can guard against it.